the birds had flown south for the winter, where they could find a warmer climate and food to eat. All except one little bird with a broken wing. He could not join them, and winter was already there. There was snow on the ground, and it was cold. He looked at the trees in the forest around him, and he thought, well, perhaps the trees could shelter me until spring when my friends returned. First, he approached the beautiful birch tree. Oh, birch tree, he said, I have broken my wing, and I cannot fly south for the winter like my friends do, and would you let me shelter in your branches until spring? The birch tree drew herself up and looked at him and said, we have our own birds. No, I can't help you. Oh, dear, thought the little bird, perhaps her branches are not strong enough. So, but there's the mighty oak. I will ask him. The little bird hopped across the snow, and when he got to the oak tree, he said, oh, mighty oak, I have a broken wing. I cannot fly south for the winter with my friends. May I shelter in your branches until they return in the spring? The oak tree looked at him and said, well, you want to do what? You want to shelter in my branches until spring? Huh, you would eat all my acorns. No, I can't help you. Well, the little bird thought, what will I do now? And then he noticed the graceful willow tree. He hopped over there and said, oh, graceful willow, I have broken my wing, and I cannot fly south for the winter with my friends. May I shelter in your branches until spring? Her reply was not very graceful. Who are you? You're a stranger here. I don't talk to strangers. Maybe someone else can help you. Goodbye. Now the little bird didn't know what to do. He tried to fly. He flapped his wing, but couldn't even get off the ground. And then he heard a voice that said, little bird, what are you doing? Where are you going? It was Spruce Tree. I don't know where I'm going, and it is so cold. I don't know how I'm going to survive the winter. Well, replied Spruce, the trees of the forest should help you if your friends have left you all alone. My branches are thick and soft, and you may shelter there. Can I really? Asked the little bird. Why, yes, we should help you. And then he heard another voice. Well, my branches are not as soft, but I'm tall and strong, and I can keep the north wind from both you and Spruce Tree. It was Pine Tree. And then another voice chimed in and said, well, little bird, you may eat my berries. Birds love my berries. It was Juniper. So now the little bird had food and shelter for the winter. That night, Old Man North Wind appeared before King Frost. He asked King Frost, may I blow my cold and frosty breath through the trees of the forest tonight? The king replied, yes, you may do, but you may not touch the branches of pine and spruce and juniper, who are giving shelter to a little bird with a broken wing. And that night, Old Man North Wind blew as hard as he could through all the trees of the forest, except the pine and the spruce and the juniper. And in the morning, the branches of the oak tree, the willow tree, and the birch tree were stark and bare. All of their leaves lay scattered upon the ground. Today, when you walk through the forest, whenever, any time of year, you will notice that the leaves of pine and spruce and juniper are ever green. This story is Winter's Gift by Jane Monroe Donovan. It was December 24th, and the day before, a blizzard had swept through the area. Snow covered the ground. An old man woke up that morning. Oh, his bones ached. Must be more snow on the way, he thought to himself. He lived in an old farmhouse at the edge of town, and he thought, well, this afternoon I should go out and chop some firewood. Later in the day, he dressed in his parka, warm boots, gloves, hat. Axe in hand, he went out to the woodpile. Oh, the snow glistened in the late afternoon sun, and there were fresh deer tracks, and a crow called from a nearby treetop. As he began to chop the firewood, he started remembering Christmases past, how on this day he and his wife would walk into the nearby woods looking for the perfect Christmas tree. And when they found it, they would bring it home. He would set it up, and while he added the lights, his wife would make hot tea and sandwiches. And when they'd finished eating, they got out the decorations and began to trim the tree. The very last ornament that he would place on the top was a beautiful silver star. And as he did so, his wife would always say, "A star is the sign of hope. No matter how bad things are, you must always have hope." This year, there would be no Christmas tree, no star, for his wife had passed away that spring. The old man now gathered an armload of wood and trudged through the snow back into the house. In the nearby woods, a mare who had become separated from her herd of wild horses during the blizzard, wandered all alone. Because of the blowing wind and driving snow, she had fallen behind. And now, when the weather had cleared, she had been unable to find the rest of the herd. She would whinny occasionally, but she was getting so tired. And when she came to a small clearing in the woods, she was exhausted. Gave one last whinny, and collapsed in the snow. It was now dark, and a few snowflakes were drifting down. The old man had finished his supper and got up, took the dishes from the table to the sink, and as he looked out the window to see if he could see the moon or the stars, he thought he heard a sound, and he recognized that sound. He quickly put on his parka, his heavy boots, his gloves, his cap, and wound a long, warm wool scarf around his neck. He picked up a lantern, and out the door he went. He walked past the woodpile, past the barn, and started into the woods. He thought he might have heard the sound again. He went a little farther into the woods and was about to give up his search when he came to the clearing. He thought he saw a dark form there. He held up the lantern, walked closer. It was the mare, and she could barely lift her head to look at him with her big brown eyes. He removed the scarf from his neck and looped it around the animal's neck and gently coaxed her to her feet. And then slowly guided her out of the woods and towards his barn. The barn had not been used for some time, for the old man no longer kept any livestock, but it was still warm and snug, and she would be safe from wind and weather. When she had her in the barn, she could hardly stand. He hurried into the house, found an old blanket, a couple of carrots, and a bucket with some water. He returned to the barn and there were still a few bales of hay and straw there in the corner, and he prepared the nearest stall, guided her in, offered her the water and carrots, and then also forked a little more hay for her to eat. Now, the old man was exhausted by his efforts. He sat down on one of the bales, leaned back, and fell asleep. He didn't wake until the next morning. The sun was shining through the window. It took him a few seconds to remember where he was and what had happened. And it dawned, well, this is Christmas morning. He stood, and he walked over to the stall. He could not believe the sight before his eyes. There, beside the mare, was a newborn foal, just getting to its up on its shaky little legs. The foal turned his head and looked at the old man. The old man saw, right in the middle of his forehead, was a white blaze in the shape of a perfect star. The old man remembered what his wife would say as they placed the star on the Christmas tree every year. That is a sign of hope, and no matter how bad things are, you should always have hope. The old man smiled, and for the first time in a long time, he looked forward to tomorrow.
Such a beautiful story.
Oh, I get teary-eyed.
I do, too. You specialize, I'll bet, in giving goosebumps and getting goosebumps, don't you?
Well, wait till you hear the one about the tablecloth. That one I start crying into because it's so touching. More Kleenex.
Wow. Wow. You know, what a great story to listen to in these trying times, isn't it? How about that? Do you know when that story was written, Sylvia?
No, but it comes from a book that I found in one of the libraries here. And you could probably find it online, Winter's Gift by Jane Monroe Donovan.
That's a wonderful story. How do you find your stories to read?
Well, you take your training, this huge notebook that you receive has not only stories like traditional fables and folk tales, but they'll give you resources. But we have, but online, there are an incredible number of websites that have collections of stories from all around the world. And you just type it in and say, I'm looking for such and such a kind of story, and you can probably find it. And that's where I often get some of the stories. Well, the stories, several of the stories I'm telling today, I found online. But often, because I tell to preschoolers through first graders in the elementary schools, I often go to the school library or the children's section of the public libraries and look for books there that would be appropriate to the age level. And quite often, I will tell a story from a book. And then afterwards, I can show the book. I said, now you can read the story. Because when we tell, we say, you have to think about the story and think about what is happening. And they may have a completely different picture or interpretation than what the original was. And that's good, too.
Well, that's part of the magic of storytelling.
Right.
It's not all given to you on a silver platter. There's room for the receiver to inject his or her imagination. Mm-hmm. Is that the magic of storytelling?
Oh, right, yes, there? Yes. And our national office has been doing surveys of the classroom teachers in the rooms that we tell to, and they have a whole questionnaire asking how the students in their class react to the storytelling and how it affects their reading, writing, listening, vocabulary, and they've gotten very positive responses. Most of the teachers are saying, yes, this is great. We love our storytelling.
How long have you been involved with Spellbinders, Sylvia?
I think it's either 9 or 10 years.
What do you get out of it?
Oh, well, in my professional life, I was a speech and language pathologist in a public school special education program. And I loved working with the kids, the teachers, the parents. But there's an awful lot of paperwork in public education, especially in special education. And now it's great to be able to interact with the children without following all the paperwork. So it's just really fun. It's fun.
So you retired and you decided that you wanted to tell stories to kids. Is that basically what happened?
Yes, I saw a little ad in the paper.
Huh.
And it said they were training storytellers. And my extracurricular activity all my life has been involved in dance and theater and music. And so I really enjoyed being able to be a storyteller.
Spellbinders has roots in this valley, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. The founding mother and father was Germaine Deitch and her husband, Al. And they started on the Front Range in Denver. And Germaine had a degree, I believe, both in senior theater and in gerontology. And she started with a group of seniors performing skits in some kind of a special program for teenagers. And the students responded so well, it sort of grew from there. And then they became an organization known as Spellbinders connect seniors with the students in the schools.
And the mission statement, according to your website, which, by the way, is spellbinders.org, restoring the art of oral storytelling to connect elders to youth, weaving together the wisdom of diverse cultures throughout time. That's great. That's magnificent.
Mm.
That's all of it right there. Do you feel like you're falling into a long tradition as you tell these stories?
Yes. Of course, before the written word was the spoken word. And there are wonderful storytelling organizations throughout the country, throughout the world. There's National Storytelling Associations. There's the Rocky Mountain Storytelling. There are all kinds of storytelling associations, both professional and for amateurs. So we're just carrying on the tradition.
And this is all volunteer on your part.
Yes, it is.
That's remarkable.
In fact, when you receive your 4-day training before you become an official spellbinder, you are charged a fee, and part of that does go towards your background check, which is pretty much required if you're working volunteering in the public schools these days.
And so tell me about that 4-day training. What did you do? How did that happen? How did that progress?
Well, I was trained by Mary Lee Hindman, who is still a very active storyteller in our valley, and Germaine Deitch. She was still there then. And you receive, as I say, a very thick notebook of materials and resources, and you are given procedures how to tell a story, and you practice in front of the trainers and each other. And they will critique you, and you critique each other. And then when you've completed this 4-day training, you observe experienced storytellers in the various classrooms. And the experienced storytellers observe the new person telling the story. And if everything appears to be you're ready to go, then you are assigned a classroom or more than one. And some people prefer the younger students. Some of them prefer the older students. Right now, we try and serve preschool through elementary. And if we had more volunteers, we would like to be able to service the middle school and possibly the high schools.
Which class are you attached to?
I tell in Basalt and in Carbondale. In Basalt, I tell preschool through first grade, both English language learners and Spanish enrichment classes, as well as the regular classrooms. And in Carbondale, I tell in first grade and a kindergarten.
Now, are you following those kids up through the grades, or are you always talking to first grade?
No, they will move on to a storyteller that perhaps tells to all the second grades. And then usually there's a storyteller that will tell to all the third grades and someone that tells to all the fourth grades. And so they won't have the same storyteller. They'll be exposed to several different books.
So you go in every week, every month?
It's typically once a month for 15 to 20 minutes. Maybe in the older students you may be allowed 30 minutes, but the teachers' schedules are so busy these days. We're lucky to get that time.
Wow, how about that? Well, I bet it's probably a little brief respite for the teacher to have you come in and read some stories.
Well, they must be in the classroom with you.
Oh, okay.
And I have had some teachers that they're sitting back there laughing at a particular story, I think more than the students. Or I've had teachers that will zero in on a particular story and say, oh, you must tell that story again this year. So it's fun to interact with the teachers as well as the students.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, is Spellbinders, as an organization, are they always looking for new storytellers?
Oh, we always need new volunteers because, as I said, we would love to be able to expand into some of the upper grades that we just don't have the personnel for at this moment.
Hmm. And how does one go about doing that?
We have, in our valley, our Roaring Fork chapter will have a training session at least once a year. But it would be best to go to our website, spellbinders.org, and the information is always available there on who to contact. Our national office is right here in Carbondale at the 3rd Street Center.
Oh, how about that? The national office at the 3rd Street Center. I didn't know that. How cool is that? I love that.
Oh, it's great. And our executive director is Catherine Johnson, who also lives in the valley here.
I'd love to hear a couple more stories.
All right. This is a story that I found online, and it says it is contributed by Pastor Rob Reed. And I don't know whether this story was original with this gentleman or whether he heard it from someone else. But the name of the story is The Tablecloth. A newly ordained young minister and his wife were assigned to their first parish. They were to reopen a church in suburban Brooklyn. When they got there in October, they looked at the building, and no doubt they exclaimed, "Heaven help us." It was in a great state of disrepair. But the young couple was full of enthusiasm, and they decided that they could have this church open for Christmas Eve services. And they went right to work. Oh, they were scrubbing and cleaning and painting and repairing. And they finished by December 18th. They were ahead of schedule. However, on December 19th, a severe driving wind and rainstorm lasted for 2 days. On the 21st, the pastor went to the church, opened the door, entered the sanctuary. Oh, no, he gasped. The roof had leaked, and the wall, the front wall of the sanctuary, right behind the pulpit, the plaster had come crashing down. There was a huge area, maybe 8 feet tall and 15 to 20 feet wide. The pastor thought, oh no, there's no way this can be repaired in time for our Christmas Eve service. As he swept up the debris from the floor, he had come to the decision, we will have to postpone our Christmas Eve service. As he left the church and walked down the block to his car, he passed a little shop next door, and there they were having a flea market to raise money for a local charity. He stopped to look at what was offered, and his eye was caught by this beautiful crocheted tablecloth. Oh, the colors were gorgeous, and right in the center, there was an embroidered cross. Ah, the pastor thought, now, we can have that Christmas Eve service after all. How much is that tablecloth? He asked the proprietor. And when told the price, the pastor, yes, I can do that. He hurried back down the street to the church with the tablecloth under his arm and noticed that there was an older woman running down the street toward him to the bus stop that was almost in front of the church. She didn't make it in time. The bus left without her. It was cold, and it was starting to snow. The pastor walked up to the older woman and said, "Ma'am, would you like to wait inside my church? It's 45 minutes until the next bus arrives." The woman accepted his offer, followed him in, and sat quietly in one of the back pews. The pastor got his ladder and tools and went to the wall with the missing plaster and went right to work, hanging the tablecloth as a wall hanging. When he had finished, he stepped back to admire his work. And he turned around, and, well, the woman had come down the aisle and was standing right behind him. And she said, "Where did you get that tablecloth? It looks just like the one I made 35 years ago when I lived in Austria. Would there be the initials CEG in the lower corner?" The pastor stepped forward and looked, and, "Well, yes, there are. Those initials are in the corner." And the woman continued, "My husband and I were fairly well-to-do, but when the Nazis came to Austria, my husband insisted that I leave, and he would join me later. But I was captured later, and after the war, I never saw my husband or my home again for 35 years." The pastor offered the woman the tablecloth. "Oh, no," she said. It is best here. I want the church to have it." "Well," said the minister, can I at least offer you a ride home?" The woman accepted. She had come to Brooklyn for a house cleaning job, but she lived on the other side of Staten Island. On Christmas Eve, the service was beautiful, the music, the spirit, and as the congregation left, the pastor and his wife greeted the folks at the door, and many said they would be returning. The pastor went back into the sanctuary, and there was still someone there. There was a man sitting in one of the front pews, and he was staring at the tablecloth. The pastor approached, and the man asked him, "Where did you get that tablecloth? It looks exactly like one that my wife made over 35 years ago when we lived in Austria. There surely can't be two identical tablecloths." The minister was stunned, and the man went on, "You see, when the Nazis came to Austria, I insisted that my wife leave. I was going to join her later, but I was arrested and imprisoned. After the war, I never again saw my house or my wife." The minister smiled at the man. "Sir, may I take you for a ride?" he asked. He drove the man across to the other side of Staten Island to the same apartment house where he had taken the woman 3 days earlier. He helped the older man walk up the stairs, and they knocked on the door of the apartment. And when the door opened, the pastor saw the greatest Christmas reunion he could ever imagine.
Wonderful. That's wonderful. Does every good story have to have that serendipitous aspect, or maybe not, doesn't have to, but they often do, don't they?
Yes, they often do.
Because that's sort of what makes us human, maybe. Do you think that's it?
Yes, I think a story has to touch you, and that is one thing we talk about when we're learning to be storytellers, that you should tell a story that speaks to you.
Uh-huh. That makes perfect sense, because then you can touch somebody else. If it touches you first, you can touch somebody else with it. That's wonderful. Do you have another story for us, Sylvia?
Well, I do have another one. This is a shorter one. Again, I found this online. It is The Soul of a Menorah by Eric A. Kimmel. A Polish farmer had delivered a load of hay to the livery stable in the little town of Chelm. When he'd finished unloading, he threw his hay fork in the back of his cart, climbed on, shook his horse's reins, and started down the street and headed for home. The cart happened to hit a big bump in the road, and the hay fork was jostled out of the back of the cart and fell right in the middle of the street. The farmer had no idea this had happened and just continued on his way. Down the street came two wise men discussing some heavy matter of the day, but they stopped when right before them they could not believe their eyes. Why, it was a Hanukkah menorah, a Hanukkah. Why, they could not believe it. There were the eight branches, all the same length. There was the branch in the middle, the longer one, for the Shamus candle. Why, surely God had thrown it down from heaven right to them. The two wise men picked it up, took it home and cleaned it up and polished it, and they took it right to the great synagogue of Chelm. And that very evening, there were candles placed on it for the sixth day of Hanukkah, and they were lit for the evening prayer service. When the farmer got home, he tended to his horse, and as he left the barn and walked behind his cart, he saw his hay fork was missing. Oh, it was too late in the day to try and find where he had lost it. That would wait till tomorrow. The farmer then went to the synagogue that evening for the prayer service. He no sooner stepped inside than he looked. Why, there was his hay fork. That's my hay fork, he exclaimed. And before he could reach and reclaim his property, the two wise men had stepped right in front of him to block him, and they started saying, "Well, no, that is a menorah that we received this afternoon. No. Well, the argument became very heated. But before the men could come to blows, the local rabbi stepped in and said, "No, we will take this to the seer of Lublin, Rabbi Jacob Isaac, and let him decide." So the rabbi, the two wise men, and the farmer started down the road. But by now, everyone in the village had heard about the situation and were following them. When they appeared before Rabbi Isaac, he listened very carefully to both sides of the story, pondered a while, then he said, "No, it is a menorah." And then he went on to explain that when an ordinary object has been used for a sacred purpose, why, it retains sparks of holiness and can never be used for an ordinary purpose again. Why, that would be a sin. And then he looked at the two wise men. "However," he said, the farmer has lost his hay fork. Therefore, you must reimburse him 18 zlotys. 18 zlotys, the two men exclaimed. Why, well, for a hay fork? 18? Meanwhile, the farmer, hearing all this, realized that he might appear to be the winner after all. And he turned to the two wise men and exclaimed, why, what do you think? Can't you recognize a menorah when you see one? So, today, if you go to the Grand Synagogue of Chelm, the famous menorah there may well look like a hay fork, but it has the soul of a menorah.
And the moral of the story is a repurposed hay fork as menorah. How about that? Do you find some traditions around the world more fertile for storytelling than others?
Not necessarily. As I say, when you start researching things online, there is just a wealth of material about just about anything you could ask for. And there are stories from all around the world, all different cultures, for all different seasons.
Aesop's fables come to mind. Mother Goose. Do you read Mother Goose?
Well, there are often adaptations, or people will take a Mother Goose rhyme or develop a story from it. In fact, this wasn't on our agenda originally, but there is a story called Mother Hubbard's Christmas.
Mother Hubbard, old Mother Hubbard.
Yes, who went to her cupboard to get her poor doggy a bite. But when she got there, the cupboard was bare, and the dog was singing Silent Night. Oh, she went to the town to shop at the stores, but when she came home, the dog had locked all the doors. She went out to the woods to chop down a tree. She brought it back, and the dog had chopped it in three. She went to the front door to hang up a wreath. She came inside. The dog was brushing his teeth. She went out to the driveway to shovel a path. She came in. The dog was taking a bath. She climbed up a ladder to put lights on the house. She came down. The dog was holding a mouse. She went upstairs to the attic to find his ice skates. She came down. The dog was juggling plates. She went to the kitchen to cook him a roast. She turned round. He was dressed like a ghost. And then she poured him a cup of holiday cheer. He came in riding a reindeer. She sat down at the piano to play him a carol. But when she started, he hid in a barrel. She gave him a gift. He got one of his own. She got a necktie. The dog got a necktie, and she got a bone. Then they sat down at a dinner to sup that the dog had cooked up. She gave a curtsy, and he gave a bow. She said, Merry Christmas. And the dog said,
Bow wow.
Ho, ho. Oh.
Not Bow Wow. You told that by memory.
Well, most of our stories are that way.
Are they?
Except, as you know, today I'm cheating a little because I just found several of these wonderful Christmas stories and didn't have time to memorize them yet.
So you just found them. How about that? What was it about the story that said, that's the one, I have to tell that one?
Well, they just, as I say, they appeal to you. There's something that just, that's just right.
So you don't over-intellectualize it. You just, it's instinctual.
Well, for school, I often ask the classroom teacher if there's a particular subject they're studying. If it's something in science, I would try and find a story. Or if they say, well, we're going to be studying this, you know, and I will try and find something to fit their curriculum.
Sylvia Wendrow, you have one more story for us, don't you?
Well, yes. This Yay! One I just found.
Nice.
And I'm going to, you know, fudge a little on this one because I don't have it learned from memory yet. But it is called A Politically Correct Christmas. And the author is listed as anonymous. 'Twas the night before Christmas and Santa's a wreck. How could he live in a world that's politically correct? His workers no longer would answer to elves. Vertically challenged, they were calling themselves. And labor conditions at the North Pole, well, they were alleged by the union to stifle the soul. Four reindeer had vanished, without much propriety, for they had been released to the wilds by the Humane Society. And equal employment had made it quite clear that Santa had better not use just reindeer. So Dancer and Donner and Comet and Cupid were replaced with four pigs. And you know that looked stupid. The runners had been removed from his beautiful sleigh because the ruts were deemed dangerous by the EPA. And millions of people were calling the cops when they heard sled noises upon their rooftops. A secondhand smoke from Santa's pipe had his workers quite frightened, and his fur-trimmed red suit was called unenlightened. To show you the strangeness of today's ebbs and flows, Rudolph was suing over unauthorized use of his nose. He went to Geraldo, and in front of the nation, demanded millions in overdue workers' compensation. So, half the reindeer were gone, and now his wife, who suddenly said she'd had enough of this life, joined a self-help group, packed, left in a whiz, demanding that from now on her title was Ms. And as for gifts, why, he'd never had the notion that making a choice could cause such a commotion. Nothing of leather, nothing of fur, which meant nothing for him and nothing for her. Nothing to aim, and nothing to shoot, nothing that clamored or made lots of noise, and nothing just for girls, and nothing just for boys, and nothing that claimed to be gender-specific. Nothing that's warlike or non-pacifistic. No candy or sweets. They were bad for the tooth. And nothing that seemed to embellish upon the truth. And fairy tales, well, not yet forbidden, were like Ken and Barbie, better oft hidden. For they raised the hackles of those psychological who claimed the only good gift was one ecological. No baseball. No football. Someone might get hurt. And besides, playing sports exposed kids to dirt. Dolls were said to be sexist and should be passé, and Nintendo would rot your entire brain away. So Santa just stood there, disheveled and perplexed. He just couldn't figure out what to do next. He tried to be merry, and he tried to be gay, but you must have to admit he was having a very bad day. His sack was quite empty. It was flat on the ground. Nothing fully acceptable was anywhere to be found. Something special was needed, a gift that he might give to us all without angering the left or the right. A gift that would satisfy, with no indecision, each group of people in every religion, every race, every hue, everyone, everywhere, even you. So here is that gift, its price beyond worth. May you and your loved ones enjoy peace on earth.
Gotta love that. Thank you, Sylvia Wendra. I'm glad that you ended things on an adult note.
I already have one friend asking for me to share this so she can share it with friends at Christmas.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. Well, I trembled a little bit when you said anonymous, that it was written by anonymous, because, you know, anonymous online is not very savory. But somebody crafted that and did good with it. I thought that was very clever. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We appreciate you and your efforts and your organization, Sylvia Wendrow of Spellbinders. Thank you.
Thank you.